Bruce here with Sports Lit 101 this afternoon. You got some poetry for us.
Yeah, I do, because I will admit that I haven't finished the book I was originally planning to have. But I was looking through one of the latest issues of Athlon, and I was thinking about how we talk about sports poetry and how it's always got to be about something else. It can't be just about baseball. It can't be just about hockey. And there, these are some very much like that. This was by a guy named Albert Haley. It's called Credo in Deum, which I think you could translate from Latin a couple of ways. This is what they call the Apostles' Creed. It could also be belief in God. That impossible shot from full court that has us both frozen in our seats as it arcs through the air and even the shooter doesn't understand how it's left his hand. A miraculous heave that combines perfect desire and precision, leaving me to think one can live a lifetime without seeing this. Yet here it is, unbelievable, undeniable, and I'll be able to recall the rest of my days, that soundless sound on the far end, followed by a crisp, soulful swish, and the joyful crowd and shouts pouring out of you, out of me, when simultaneously we both leap to our feet, and the ball goes in, and the ball comes out, drops down, kisses hardwood, and right then, exulting en masse, I turn to you, almost tell you that if you can give me something as beautiful and improbable as this, I might be able to pretend finally to believe in your God.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Like
yeah.
That.
Yeah. That one really blew me away. That was the one that made me look through the rest of these poems. Here's another one that I love, because I remember when my older son was playing basketball on a not very good basketball team. He was a good athlete, but basketball was not his game. How they were playing a team where the coach was happy to win by 60 in a elementary school game, and was running it up by constantly telling his player, go left, they can't go left, until one of our players stepped in front of him and the kid went down and bruised his elbow. Anyway, this is called Growing Up, and it's by Dave Nielsen. At night, my dad told stories about the professional player he used to admire who only dribbled with his right hand, until a reporter asked, how come you never dribble left? And he said, because no one stops me when I go right. Dad would laugh, then look at me dead serious. We both knew I'd never be that good. So every day I shot 100 left-handed layups, keeping track on a yellow piece of paper I took with me to the gym. Now and then Dad would come to and rebound, admonishing me to aim for the back of the rim, get my elbow in, and put some damn arch on my shot. We'd end with a game of one-on-one, me against the big man, all 6'7" of him, mano-a-mano. The first time I beat him, I was 12. With a leaping left laner from the left side that banked home soft for the win. He'd been playing hard, and I knew it. By the time I was 14, it was like taking candy from a baby. There were games where I told myself I was only going to touch the ball with my left hand, just to give him a chance. So that game lasted more than, say, 3 minutes. 21, win by 4, only I'd beat him by 16. All because he told me the story about the dude who couldn't go left. I found something just wonderfully sweet about that poem. Let me see where the next one is. A friend of mine once said that, mentioned to me how we all take out our aggressions in different ways. Some people go for a run. Some people shout and scream. He liked to go hit a heavy bag. He just knew until he wore himself out. And then I saw this poem by David Evans Jr. called Heavy Bag, and I thought I'd take a look at it, and I liked it a lot. Heavy bag. I'm moving around it, slugging it toe to toe. My right sinks in, my left sings out. I sing out blow by blow, I slug and sweat and sing. The chain rattles to an uppercut, a right hook, a violent left cross. And the leather glistens, a mute canvas glistening, and I picture a face of someone I hate. And the chain rattles, and the chain rattles, and I slug and sweat and sing. And I sing out blow by blow, and I go to the shower, light in my calves, flicking jabs at the universe. that sort of senseless thing that works. And let me get to this one. This is called Post Game by Thomas Reynolds. Post game, nothing brings us down after a road win. Popcorn stuck to our boots delights us. Crossing the court's floor's golden sea we shake their dolphin's mascot's flipper. A crushed popcorn box is stuck in his blowhole. We pat his back and inquire about his breathing. Inside is a 5'4" freshman drowning in sweat, wheezing from a cold, needing to study for a geometry test. Snowflakes swirl about our faces as we exit. Air becomes pinched and tight down the steps. We pull hats low and collars up. Road home is long and winding. Leaves and snow fog blow across. A leaping buck nearly grazes our bumper. Yet our chatter is long-running, approaching holy and farcical. We exit the truck cab. While wind doesn't know what to do with us, slapping our faces to cheer us down, and the front door, old curmudgeon, just stares and glares. One of the things that makes the poetry in Athlon so good is that it's chosen by Ron, friend of the show, Ron Smith, who's former poet laureate of Virginia and someone who takes poetry very, very seriously. We got a couple more here. This one is called "With Baseball, It's Always Spring." This is by Robert Hamblin. We've read some of Robert Hamblin's poetry before. "With Baseball, It's Always Spring." I thought about Vin Scully when I was reading this earlier today. Old age has its advantages. One is the full right and privilege of playing fast and loose with the truth. You know those stories about walking 2 miles to school and all that ice and snow and those huge fish you caught in the night you met Elvis? Mine have to do with baseball. The older I get, the better player I become. In another few years, I'll be an All-American. I'm aided and abetted by a nephew who swears I was the best ball player in the family. And that from a man whose 2 sons played college ball and whose grandson, only a high school junior, has already been awarded a scholarship to play for Ole Miss. Still, here's the story David tells, and I gladly accept it as gospel. As a young boy, he sat in the bleachers with my father, his grandfather, and they both leaped to their feet and cheered when I hit a mammoth home run in the Mississippi State All-Star Game. Now, to my knowledge, there was no state all-star game in my day, and had there been, I probably wouldn't have been invited to play in it. Moreover, while it's true I hit more than a few home runs, I doubt any of them would be ranked as mammoth. But I suppose to a 7-year-old boy, any game and home run you viewed with a man you love more than anyone except your own father might be considered heroic. Mm. There is a kind of truth to be found in the myths we construct and live by. Sometimes there's more certainty in fiction than in fact. I never played catch with my father, an older man who had a 4th-grade education and who worked 6 days a week at a poor-paying job to support his family. He seldom had time to attend the games I played and occasionally starred in. But in the ways that really counted, he was always there for me. And David is right to misremember him as seated in those bleachers in that long-ago summer, watching me play and cheering me on. Oh, yeah, that's, again, by Robert Hamblin. Then the other day, I was remembering the most outrageous quintuple negative I ever heard in my life. Janet and I were in a store. We're visiting a friend of the show, Don Johnson, and his wife, Carolyn, down. They live in Elizabethton, which is right near Johnson City, Tennessee, place you've been, ETSU.
Yes.
And we're in the produce department, and Don had said, can you pick up tomatoes or something like that? And there was a young kid, I'd say 22, 23 years old. He had his khaki shorts and his red sneakers and his red Kroger's or whatever it was, chop. And he unleashed the greatest quintuple negative while speaking to a friend. And I thought about how sometimes you see things and you can't even believe you saw them or they shouldn't happen, but you know they're true. So this is a poem I've been working on the last couple of weeks called Southern Syntax. A young man stocking produce in East Tennessee said, "Ain't nobody didn't order nothing when I wasn't here on vacation." The most elegant quintuple negative I've ever heard. A sentence that makes no sense, but whose meaning is as clear as a tribal tattoo. Cry of a hungry child, peal of thunder on a humid August afternoon. The poetic beauty in that sundered southern syntax, a hole in one, around the horn triple play, desperation half-court three-point buzzer beater, a Hail Mary cradled in the receiver's open hands, game-winning backhander up where mama hides the cookies, or a Penobscot salmon taking a caddis fly on a September morning.
Oh, I like that.
I like it too. It's getting there. It's going to do some. Probably needs some more work. But that's one thing I encourage people. Athlon is you can subscribe. It's great. There are plenty more in here. If we had time, I could read. There are so many good ones. But it also has great fiction and other really cool stories, and occasional academic articles. AETHLON. It's really inexpensive. You don't even have to belong to SLA. You can just order the journal if you choose.
Excellent. Thank you, Bruce.
My pleasure, sir.
Speaking of terrific writing, our friend Joe Poznanski with a wonderful piece today on Vin Scully.
That's great.
I thought I'd share a little of it with you. Joe writes, the last time I saw Vin Scully was a Wednesday in May in the City of Angels, and we were at the ballpark, his ballpark, Dodger Stadium. And one more time I asked him about the old radio. Joseph, he said to me, how many times have I told you this story? He smiled. How many times had it been? A half dozen, a dozen? But he always obliged. And Vin began like he always began. When I was about 8 years old, he said, I used to crawl underneath a big four-legged radio and listen to college football. In those days, college football was pretty much the only sport you could hear on the radio. When talking with Vin, even in the most casual of moments, there was always a temptation to close your eyes and just listen like he was talking to you through that old four-legged radio. Henry, he might say, if Henry Aaron's name came up, well, Henry had a certain grace about him. He ran a little bit different. And yes, I would want to close my eyes and turn up the volume. Willie, he continued, now talking about Willie Mays. Now, Willie ran with his hat flying off and joy just coming off him like sparks. But Henry, there was something regal about Henry, opposite of Willie, who was a sandlot kid playing with all of us. And understand, Willie did play stickball in the streets of New York, as I did when I was a kid. Henry was just a little bit apart. He was just a regal player from the first time I saw him. It is not anything special to say I loved Vin Scully. We all loved him. We all loved him for the things he used to say. How good was Stan Musial, he once said? Good enough to take your breath away. Bob Gibson pitches like he's double parked. Football is to baseball, Vin Scully once said, like blackjack is to bridge. One is the quick jolt, the other the deliberate, slow-paced game of skill. And we loved him for the things he didn't say, like the moment after Aaron hit his 715th home run. I took off the headset and I went to the back of the booth and I got a little water, he would say, and I just stood there watching this marvelous moment. There was nothing else I could say. We loved Vin Scully for being there always, night after night game, day game after day game, continuously finding a new story to coax a smile, a new description that caught us a bit by surprise, continuously finding the same level of delight he had been feeling for 70 years of calling baseball games and other sports. Vin, like all of us, lived a life of great joys and great sadness, a life of thrills and pain, but unlike all of us, Vin Scully never stopped being that kid in the Bronx sitting under the radio.